I would like to first thank Youngstown State University and the Rose Melnick Medical Museum for inviting me to speak and be a part of this exhibition today. I think that it is both powerful and insightful to combine a discussion of the history of post-traumatic stress disorder and war trauma, or the mental and emotional tolls of war, with an exhibition that focuses on the physical. I wish that I could have traveled to the museum to see this exhibition and to be there to speak with you today, but I am grateful for this opportunity to speak with you and to share my work. So thank you. Today I will be talking about the social history of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, as shaped by the cultural narratives surrounding it. But before I dive in, I want to begin by mentioning what I will and will not be talking about. This presentation focuses on PTSD in male soldiers. Although PTSD is present in the female soldier population, this presence is largely associated with sexual assault and sexual trauma. This is often called military sexual trauma under the acronym MST, rather than battlefield trauma, which is the source of PTSD in the male population largely. Since the basis of PTSD in the female population is this military sexual trauma, it warrants unique examination and reflection as a topic separate from the social history of war trauma. Also, by focusing on the history of PTSD in the military, this means that men become the object of study simply because the military has a long history as a single-sex organization. That being said, I do not want people to leave this lecture believing that PTSD is a problem unique to the male soldier. Many female soldiers suffer and have suffered from the far-reaching symptoms and consequences of this disorder. However, in this presentation, I will examine the history of war trauma and PTSD in the male population. By analyzing primary and secondary sources and personal accounts, as well as academic and popular press sources, we will explore the stories that our culture tells itself in order to understand this ambiguous disorder. Namely, I will show that understandings of PTSD and related disorders have been really tightly bound to concepts of heteronormativity, meaning that they have been shaped by understandings of the ideal man, as well as concepts of masculinity and male virtues. The history of medicine is a social one. So, although medical knowledge and its history are often understood as objective fact, which is understood to be kind of divorced from cultural and social context, these are assumptions that should be undermined. Historically, the way a disease has been understood, treated, and talked about is shaped not only by medical knowledge, but also by broader cultural, social, and even political climates and ideologies. This social construction of disease is evident across the history of medicine, but is perhaps among the most prominent in the history of mind-body medicine, such as post-traumatic stress disorder. Cultural mores surrounding gendered social roles have long shaped both the medical understanding of PTSD and its related predecessors, as well as the way its victims have and are treated and regarded within the societal framework. PTSD is a complex and complicated disorder, which lies at the intersection of the mind and the body, making it difficult to treat and to comprehend. According to historian Anne Harrington, a cultural inability to understand the non-physical properties that lead to disease and ill health has caused Western society to explain these health problems through a variety of narratives. Harrington grounds Western culture's inability to comprehend mind-body medicine in Western medicine's foundational assumption of the physicality of illness. Namely, Western medicine believes that physical illness must have a physical cause. This assumption is what makes mind-body medicine so complicated. Due to the ambiguity and the lack of understanding surrounding these connections between mind and body, physicalist cultures such as ours must turn to narratives as a way of explaining what does not fit into the physicalist medical paradigm. These narratives are useful in understanding the experiences of bodies and minds and how they have been understood within specific cultural contexts throughout history. Harrington proposes six narratives, which I will not explore today for the sake of time. However, none of these narratives adequately address the cultural stories and explanatory devices that are employed surrounding battlefield or war trauma and the history of PTSD. And so in my work, I have explored yet another cultural narrative beyond the six that Harrington explores in her work. Throughout my research, my talks and my articles, I've entitled this proposed narrative, Emasculated by Trauma. And I'm going to trace the history of this cultural narrative here with you today. The title, Emasculated by Trauma, that I use stems from the fact that the history of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and other war-related traumatic disorders before the diagnostic category of PTSD was labeled, represents a study in evolving sensibilities, social mores, and gendered cultural expectations that are related to masculinity. Since its first appearance on the battlefield, PTSD and its predecessors were essentially used to symbolize the manifestation of societal concerns surrounding unfulfilled gender roles that were very tightly bound to these concepts of heteronormativity, men acting like men, women acting like women. Trauma-related nervous disorders became the mark of someone who had failed to live up to culturally constructed notions of the ideal male citizen soldier. Thus, victims were blamed for their unmanly behavior by way of stigmatizing medical diagnoses. They were understood to be somehow less manly, to be emasculated in some way, either by the trauma itself, or as we will see in the earliest descriptions, by a pre-existing condition, or rather a psychiatric personal or familial weakness. So, soldiers suffering the effects of trauma show an inability to exhibit the virtues of the ideal male. By failing to meet expected gender norms and fulfill male gender roles, soldiers are and have been, you know, expected to be fearless. But trauma-related nervous disorders such as PTSD really serve to expose the vulnerabilities and frailty of these men. Therefore, this narrative explains both a soldier's failure to fulfill cultural expectations of men, as well as cultural institutional notions of the good soldier, since the good soldier is supposed to be strong and fearless, and their reaction, this succumbing to this trauma-related nervous disorder is exposing this vulnerability, this failure. The history of mind-body medicine is one that venerates the narrative form, recognizing the cultural need for stories that explain the otherwise essentially unexplicable. For this reason, stories are essential to the history of mind-body medicine. As Harrington has argued, these narratives allow that a physicalist culture to find meaning and explanation in diseases and illness that fall far beyond the Western medical paradigm. However, as I've just briefly mentioned and will explore in greater depth, the narrative surrounding PTSD does more than that. This narrative both makes sense of a mind-body disorder in a physicalist medical paradigm and seeks to make sense of behavior that does not align with the specifically gendered expectations of a heteronormative society. Thus, this narrative represents a medico-cultural attempt to explain behavior that does not conform to gendered social and institutional norms. So now we will turn to the history of PTSD by examining these shifting cultural narratives. So the first discussions of trauma-related nervous disorders are on the battlefield beginning during the early 1800s. During this time, military doctors had begun to diagnose soldiers with what they called, quote, exhaustion. Following the stress of battle, this exhaustion was often characterized by such things as mental shutdown as a result of trauma. Now, unable to treat this ambiguous disorder, physicians resorted to the mere prescription of rest. Since these men were supposed to possess the strength to stave off fear, or at the very least hide it, these soldiers were treated with what was called in military parlance, three hots and a cot, or three hot meals and a cot to sleep on, before being sent back to the front lines to continue fighting. At this time, exhaustion was not understood as a legitimate illness or disability, but rather simply physical exhaustion. To put it very bluntly, these soldiers were men. And because of this and their innately male qualities, they were understood to be strong, and thus they could not be understood to be scared or traumatized. They could only be understood to be tired and thus in need of rest. Thus, they only needed three hots and a cot before they could return to battle. They were only suffering from exhaustion, not war-related trauma, despite the fact that this kind of physical shutdown and other symptoms that physicians discuss in the writings of this time are very similar to what we now recognize to be post-traumatic stress disorder. In 1876, Dr. Mendez da Costa medicalized this exhaustion by publishing a paper that created the diagnostic category of soldier's heart among Civil War combat veterans. Dr. da Costa's concept of soldier's heart grew out of the work of another doctor, Dr. Arthur Meyer. Meyer had observed that combat soldiers serving in active war zones often exhibited distress that was characterized by arousal of the cardiovascular system. Symptoms included extreme fatigue, palpitations, sweating, tremors, and loss of consciousness. By locating the heart as the problem. This explanation attempted to provide a physical explanation. Thus, it attempted to rationalize or explain this disordered behavior according to a physicalist paradigm. Now, those who have studied the history of nervous disorders know that they often have many names, and Soldier's heart was no different. This disorder was also known under the names irritable heart, effort syndrome, nostalgia, and DaCosta syndrome. After the work of Myers and DaCosta, interest in the study of trauma waned until the brutality of World War I really hurled the focus of their work back into the spotlight. By the winter of 1914, there was an epidemic of mental breakdown among the troops. And by the end of World War I, over 80,000 cases had been seen by military physicians. Soldiers fighting in this horrendous trench warfare experienced many things that contributed to their war trauma, including prolonged exposure to constant threats against their own life, while also witnessing the mutilation and deaths of their friends and close comrades. Due to this constant bombardment of trauma, it was said that the soldiers, quote, began to act like hysterical women. They screamed and wept uncontrollably. They froze and could not move. They became mute and unresponsive. They lost their memory and the capacity to feel. Here we can see the alignment of this behavior with femininity and the female. These soldiers are thus emasculated by their behavior, by the cultural narrative. Here it should be noted that the history of nervous disorders is a female history. Disorders such as hysteria were the realm of women, not men. Thus, by succumbing to nervous disorders, these men were essentially becoming women, according to the culture. That was the only way it could be understood. But of course, this is not the only point. Their main failure in the eyes of the culture, if you want to put it that way, and failure in the eyes of the physician, was their traumatization, their showing of weakness. There was a fallacious belief that men should be completely unaffected by war. The only effect that might be allowed is that they could be made stronger by it. Thus, by failing to do so, by being made weaker, by being traumatized, they were not the ideal man. They were emasculated in some way. DaCosta's concept of the soldier's heart then fell away, and a British military psychiatrist named Charles Samuel Myers coined a new term, shell shock. Falling in line with the physicalist thinking of many Europeans, Dr. Myers postulated that shell shock was caused by cerebral concussions and the rupture of small blood vessels resulting from close proximity to exploding shells. By formulating the nervous illness in this way, by making it something physical, it provided an honorable explanation of symptoms and behaviors that served to really remove blame and stigma from the individual soldier. It wasn't their fault. Something physical was happening to them. They were suffering from concussions and rupturing blood vessels. However, this initial explanation was later found to become inadequate when soldiers who had not served in live warfare and not been exposed to these kind of exploding shells began to exhibit symptoms of the disorder. This led Myers to distinguish the neurological condition of shell concussion from the psychological disorder of shell shock. That could be caused by exposure to the intense and horrific conditions of warfare. So while the first one, shell concussion, had a physical cause, the proximity to exploding shells, which caused concussions and the rupture of small blood vessels, shell shock was a psychological disorder without a physical cause and was rather caused by simply exposure to the intense and horrific conditions of war. The differentiation between the neurological and the psychological served to delineate two different and specific patient populations. The good soldier, who was a man that was both strong and brave and might succumb to shell concussion as it had a physical cause and was thus unavoidable. However, physicians of the time began to stigmatize victims of shell shock, of course, as they saw them as weaker men. They were unfit to be real soldiers and unfit for war. These men had no physical reason to act as they did. Their only reason was an innate psychiatric weakness, a familial or personal weakness, and perhaps a moral failure. In his book titled The Anatomy of Courage, war psychiatrist Lord Moran recounted very stigmatizing descriptions of psychiatric casualties, such as the following. Quote, "There were others who were plainly worthless fellows. One without moral sense had taken a commission under the shadow of compulsion. Sitting there with his head in his hands at the bottom of the trench, he could do no good to the men of 1916. He was a worthless chap, without shame, the worst product of the towns." End quote. So it's very significant in reading this quote to mention that compulsory service was often blamed for high rates of psychiatric illness or nervous disorders. The cultural narrative of this time often explained the high rates of nervous disorders as a result of compulsory service, forcing men who were not fit to be soldiers into the services. These men did not live up to the cultural image or the cultural ideal of masculinity. This cultural ideal of masculinity is described by Elaine Shoalwater. The public image of the Great War, of World War I, had been one of very strong, unreflective masculinity. In fact, the values promoted within the male community of this time was, quote, "the ability to tolerate the appalling filth and stink of the trenches, the relentless noise, and the constant threat of death with stoic good humor," end quote. Soldiers who had been wounded in the mind failed to live up to this image. This belief, this ideal of masculinity, presented difficulty for the suffering soldier. As we now recognize, war is a traumatic place. Being traumatized there is a function of environment, not personal weakness. However, at this point in history, the heteronormative society really expected an unfaltering strength from men in the battlefield, regardless of what they saw or experienced. The only exception was this physical cause, this concussion, something that they could fit into this physicalist medical paradigm to help them understand men failing to live up to this male ideal. Once peace had been achieved, the plight of these soldiers once again fell away from the spotlight, and interest in the study of trauma faded again. However, once the Second World War, World War II, broke out, the ramifications of war trauma on the fighting force were again really thrust into the limelight. The term shell shock was followed in World War II by the term combat fatigue. Due to concerns about the high economic cost of psychiatric casualties during the First World War, the U.S. military began psychiatric screening of enlistees. They had hoped to avoid enlisting men who were psychologically unfit to endure the intensity of war. Essentially, they were attempting to only enlist those men that would prove to be good soldiers. They wanted to weed out those predisposed to psychological disorder and create an army of brave, strong men who could endure the horror of war. Because if war trauma was brought on by an innate psychiatric weakness, they believed that it could be identified and excluded. You could just not pick those men that had that familial or personal weakness. And then you would be left only with the strong, brave, real men that would not succumb to this kind of war trauma. Despite these efforts, however, soldiers continued to develop psychological and physical reactions to the trauma of the battlefield. This made it clear that all men were vulnerable to the terror of warfare. Everyone had their breaking point. This really helped to shift medical and cultural understanding of these victims of war trauma. It was no longer an individual biological or psychological weakness, and now it was understood that there was a role for the environment in altering psychological and physiological behavior. Although these disorders still represented a failure to fulfill expected roles, the possible vulnerability of all men in the face of war and extreme trauma was now recognized. Now, this time, once the war was over, interest in the topic did not wane, as clinicians and researchers continued to study these issues. The Vietnam War provided really an additional thrust, elevating the importance of these issues in the social and medical spheres. Since combat fatigue had been a really major source of attrition during the Second World War, as well as the Korean War, the U.S. military expected the treacherous jungle warfare of Vietnam to only increase the likelihood of an epidemic of this type of a trauma-related nervous disorder. Discussions of this type of traumatic disorder were not limited to the military and medical spheres. Lay people were also taking an interest in the disorder that was breaking the minds of America's strong young men. An example of this is Mrs. Patience Mason's book, titled Recovering from the War, A Woman's Guide to Helping Your Vietnam Veteran, Your Family, and Yourself. This book was dedicated to discussing the issues of trauma and soldiers' health. As well, and very significantly, after the Vietnam War, veterans and sympathetic mental health professionals succeeded in influencing the third revision of the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-3, in creating the diagnostic category of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. The inclusion of PTSD as a diagnostic category really represented a huge step in the legitimization and destigmatization of this disorder within society at large and the larger cultural narrative. It provided legitimization of the disorder in a way that never before existed, which spread to, or included obviously, legitimization of the victims when the sufferers in a way that had not before existed. PTSD is now described very clinically as a debilitating condition that can affect every aspect of a patient's life. Due to its multifaceted composition of mental, physical, and of course social symptoms, this psychological illness plagues many Americans and has been really increasing in prevalence in the military population due largely to the contemporary wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the horrors that soldiers who have been deployed for Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom, or OEF, OIF, have experienced there. In fact, of the more than 2 million soldiers who have been deployed to OEF, OIF, almost 25% are currently suffering from PTSD or major depression. It should also be said that PTSD is also increasing in prevalence because of advances in battlefield technology such as body armor that now is, as well as battlefield medicine, meaning that people are now surviving attacks and injuries that they would not have otherwise survived. So their bodies are surviving and they're having seen things that in a past wars they would have just died from. And so their bodies survive and their minds are battered in a way that we have not dealt with in past wars. So in light of this dramatic increase in PTSD, a great deal of biomedical research has focused on this issue. Due to this attention, our understanding of PTSD has become increasingly clinical. This medicalization has led to recognition of the validity of PTSD as a legitimate disorder, as I mentioned earlier. And this legitimization has moved away from the understanding that we saw before, the idea that it's a personal or familial failing. Now we see it as a legitimate medical disorder, and this has really helped to remove stigma. Although stigmatization still persists, it has been greatly reduced as the narrative surrounding PTSD patients, victims, or sufferers is shifting. At this moment, in fact, we are kind of living at a time with two simultaneous cultural narratives surrounding PTSD. The underlying theme that we have traced forward still persists. For many, PTSD still represents the medicalization of a soldier's inability to live up to cultural expectations of strength and is thus still stigmatizing. In a recent book published on the topic of PTSD in the court system, Justice Schuller discussed stigma as a barrier to appropriate care within the military institution. According to recent studies cited within this book, 50% of U.S. Army soldiers polled believed that seeking mental health care would harm their careers, and 60% thought they would be viewed less favorably by leaders and unit members if they sought out mental health care for PTSD. So these statistics indicate that there is still stigma associated with PTSD and with seeking care for PTSD that is very much felt by soldiers who suffer from this disorder, and that this stigmatization definitely does affect their treatment. However, another narrative is beginning to emerge, and this new narrative is not only destigmatizing, but very interestingly presents victims of PTSD in an entirely new light. These victims are no longer the weak men broken by battle, as we saw before, but now the strong men who fought at the front lines and survived. A kind of hero narrative is emerging. This signals an interesting shift in the sociocultural narrative. We can see this shift in this hero narrative that now is beginning to shape some discussions of PTSD. Injured soldiers, even those with post-traumatic stress disorder, that are returning from the deployed setting are now called wounded warriors, a term which not only commands respect, but calls attention to what they have done and where they have been. The Wounded Warrior Project, which has been around since 2003, lists its mission as, quote, to honor and empower wounded warriors. This is a very different cultural narrative than what we've been tracing, with very different language, no longer stigmatizing and emasculating accounts, but rather carefully chosen and empowering words that invoke ideas of male virtues and masculinity. There is perhaps no better a masculine ideal than the warrior. And this is very much a drastic departure from the accounts of the war trauma victims that we heard from World War I, the worthless chaps that sat there and wept, what were described as the worst products of the towns. Also interesting is that in my interviews with military physicians, I have also heard anecdotal evidence of some soldiers who have seemed to desire the diagnosis of PTSD, as if it were a badge of honor that proved that they had fought at the front lines and showed bravery. In this way, our cultural narrative of PTSD is shifting significantly from one of masculation to one of ultimate male virtue. PTSD is no longer the mark of a failed male citizen, but perhaps it is almost beginning to signify the bravest of men, the one that returns from battle, in perhaps the ultimate display of socially constructed, heteronormative male virtue. Now, we can also see this shifting narrative by exploring descriptions of a new type of PTSD, or a new category, and that is secondary PTSD. In the wake of contemporary wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we have seen an extension of the PTSD diagnostic category to include those with secondhand knowledge of the trauma of war. According to the DSM-4, PTSD can also result from the unexpected discovery of violent death, serious harm, or threat of death or injury experienced by a family member or loved one. This is known as secondary PTSD. Now, what's interesting to our discussion is that while primary PTSD, or that resulting from firsthand experience, has been able to shed a lot of its stigma, and even, as I've just showed, be associated with a new, emerging, almost hero narrative, secondary PTSD has not escaped this stigma. Those diagnosed as suffering from secondary PTSD are even more likely to be written off as malingering and seen as weak. We can place this within the narrative we have been discussing. Soldiers are supposed to be brave and strong, men that we can look up to as possessing virtues of the ideal male citizen subject. We can now accept that extraordinarily traumatic events such as those seen in war may be capable of breaking even the strongest men, and are even now beginning to see PTSD as the mark of a hero that has fought the harshest of wars at the front lines for our country, our way of life. And because of this heroic understanding of PTSD, it is perhaps even harder to understand how a good soldier could be broken by simply secondhand knowledge of these traumas. This has led to descriptions of secondary PTSD victims that mirror that of Lord Moran's useless and fearful soldier from the early 20th century. Thus, the contemporary narrative of PTSD has forked. Stigmatizing accounts of PTSD still exist, and now there exists also the hero with PTSD, presenting us with a very interesting moment in history. This social history, as told through historical narratives of Western culture, is important in understanding the disease or disorder, its treatment, and its patients, victims, or sufferers. Although soldiers are trained to kill and expected to be fearlessly unaffected by war, this is not the reality. War deeply affects them, and this must be understood. Beyond that, it is necessary to understand how Western culture has and does respond to these soldiers, and importantly, how this understanding can affect their treatment. So, I want to finish off by leaving you with this 1917 quote from Elliot Smith and T.H. Pear, which really nicely sums up and depicts the expectations of men within our heteronormative Western culture. They are expected to be strong, brave, able to suppress fear, both in the trenches and in life. And this highlights our expectations of soldiers in particular, and men in general, both in war and when they return home. Quote, "The suppression of fear and other strong emotions is not demanded only of men in the trenches. It is constantly expected in ordinary society." End quote. So with that, I would like to thank you for listening. I have put my email address here on this slide. Please feel free to contact me with any questions that you might have. And of course, if you would like to contact me for any of my references, I would also be very pleased to hear from you for that as well. I hope that you enjoyed this lecture, and I will take any questions at this point. Thank you.